You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Today is the general strike in Oakland. Joshua Holland, senior writer and editor with Alternet, who lives in San Francisco, just across the bay, hanging out in Oakland a whole lot recently, is going to be with us in about 10, 15 minutes to give us a report on what's going on there. The Greek people, it looks like, will be deciding on whether or not they're going to pay back the banksters who, you know, this half a trillion, $500 billion, well, actually, I should check my numbers. But anyhow, this incredible scam by Goldman Sachs that was that brought down Greece. Republicans in the Gang of 12 say they've got a way to solve the deficit problem. Let's give an $800 billion tax cut to the rich. Yeah, like that worked really well under Ronald Reagan and under George W. Bush. That created the deficit problem. Anyhow, that's the Gang of 12. This is hopeless. Julian Assange facing some challenges. He lost his appeal in a British court, and Fukushima is still going down. All those things. I'll give you more information on all of those as we go through the day. Plus, Ron Kuby, Curtis Sliwa, and the president of the Oakland Police Officers Association will be with us in the next couple of hours in our program. Right now, Ellen Nunes is on the line. She is with Stand Up for Democracy, Yes on 2H. Or moveToAmend.org, because I guess the Stand Up for Democracy, Yes on 2H, has gone and done been yes. Alina, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us what happened in Boulder last night.
So it was a big night for Boulder last night. Boulder voters approved a measure to call for a constitutional amendment saying that corporations shouldn't have constitutional rights and money is not free speech. Mm-hmm. And it looks like the latest count, it passed with 73.72% of the vote. So overwhelming support for this measure.
That is spectacular. 73 and change.
So, nearly 74%.
Now, by coincidence today, a whole bunch of senators, I think it's 5, 6, 7 Democratic senators, have introduced a constitutional amendment in Congress that basically says, it doesn't say corporations aren't people. It doesn't say money isn't speech. What it does say is that when Citizens United was decided and you know, basically unlocked the doors of unlimited campaign contributions, that they're going to amend the Constitution and allow Congress to say, you know, we can limit campaign contributions. And that is a power that Congress has. I'm curious your thoughts on that, shall we call it compromise?
Well, I think it's definitely a step in the right direction, and it's great to see that this dialogue is elevating. I mean, I think that the proposed amendment from these U.S. senators really goes to the core of a court ruling that was in the early 70s, the Buckley v. Vallejo, where the Supreme Court said that money was essentially free speech, and so you couldn't regulate expenditures.
Right.
So to see this proposal, which says, no, Congress and states have the right and can pass restrictions on campaign finance, is definitely a step in the right direction.
Okay. And I agree with you. I think that's a spectacular one. MoveToAmend.org is the website. How did this come about? How did you put this thing on the ballot in Boulder? And how can our listeners or viewers do the same in their own hometown?
Well, sure. So to tell you a little bit about it, first, I'm with Colorado Common Cause, and we are a partner of Move to Amend, the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center, the Boulder County Democrats, and a handful of other organizations who earlier this summer really wanted to take action on Citizens United. And that group started talking with city councilors and found a very supportive one in Macon Coles. And Councilor Coles worked with city council to put the measure on the ballot. And since July, we've really just been talking to voters to get the word out and elevate this issue.
Okay.
So I think the takeaway from Boulder is really that when you talk to the voters about this issue, there's overwhelming support.
I mean, I understand initially.
Occupy, you know, you can see it in all these things. So it's just a question of talking to groups and building the momentum.
Okay. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. The process here was the city council had to decide to put this on the ballot. They had to vote by majority to put this on the ballot. And then once it was on the ballot, the voters of Boulder could vote on it, and they did last night, 73% and change, in favor of saying, no, corporations are not people, money is not speech. And initially, the city council was against putting this on the ballot and letting the voters vote on it. by a, what, 6-3 majority, if I recall?
Yeah, there were definitely some initial concerns from council. I think part of it, which is a question we get a lot, is just, you know, what's the significance of having a city vote on something that's ultimately going to be a U.S. constitutional amendment?
Right. And this is a resolution. This is not a law.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the more groups that got involved and the more that people talked about this issue, it became clear that this really is a local issue for Boulder. I mean, Boulder is a city that has, over the years, been a real champion on money and politics issues. They passed a public financing program for their city council races. They've long supported, you know, ethics campaigns and campaign finance. And a lot of the good victories in Boulder have been undercut by the Supreme Court. So the more everyone talked about it, the more it became clear that this was a local issue and it made sense for Boulder to move forward on it.
All right. So Move to Amend has operated as a kind of an umbrella coalition. You're with Common Cause in Boulder, in Denver?
Colorado, yeah.
In Colorado. Okay. And what's that website?
It's ColoradoCommonCause.org.
Okay. ColoradoCommonCause.org.
If folks want to learn more about the Yes on 2H campaign, our website is yesontwh.org. And that has a lot of the media from the campaign, some of our campaign literature, and gives a good overview of what happened in Boulder over the last several months.
All right. So you can get a sense of how to do this in your community. Now, speaking of doing this in your community, next week, Missoula, Montana is going to be doing the same thing, essentially.
Yes.
Did you coordinate your actions with theirs or vice versa?
You know, we didn't coordinate closely, but, you know, Common Cause, Move to Amend, a lot of the groups who worked in Colorado are also working in Missoula. So I think there is some good crossover energy.
But it's like basically local Missoula folks are doing Missoula and local Boulder folks did Boulder. And pretty much anybody who wants to do it in their local community, wherever you may be living, from Maine to Southern California, from Washington State to Florida, you can do it by going to movetoamend.org and getting that information, going to yeson2h.org. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Yeson2h.org or, ColoradoCommonCause.org. This is going viral. There's a lot of this stuff. Now, how do your thoughts, Elena Nunez, we're speaking with the press contact for Stand Up for Democracy, Yes, and Yes on 2H.org. What's your take on how we move the United States Senator, House of Representatives from let's just make campaign contributions limitable as a constitutional amendment? I mean, if we're going to do a constitutional amendment, which is a BFD,
right,
to paraphrase.
Yeah,
it's a huge, difficult, hard thing. If we're going to do it, why not do it all the way? Why not say, basically, we're going to put the word natural before the word person in the 14th Amendment and just roll back 150 years of or more of Supreme Court doctrine that says that corporations are persons and have rights under the Constitution?
Right.
Isn't that a debate worth having, even though it's kind of an internecine war?
I think it's an important debate, and I think that the way for us as activists to advance that debate is by passing resolutions like this. Most of the opposition we've heard to a more broad constitutional amendment has been that it's too difficult or that it won't be popular, and I think votes like the one that happened in Boulder last night show that actually when you tell voters about this issue, they support it overwhelmingly. And
right.
The more we can provide that cover and actually show that this is popular and it's what the people want, I think the less likely we'll see a more narrow resolution or a more narrow piece of legislation or proposed constitutional amendment.
Okay, great.
But, yeah,
it's an
important conversation we have to have.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And just, you know, in the shameless plug department, but I think it's a useful resource. I wrote an entire book on this called Unequal Protection, and Truth Out is giving that book away online. You can read it online over at truthout.org, too. So that's just another resource for what it's worth.
Right.
But go ahead.
People hear about it, I think the more they talk to their friends and, you know, talk to their neighbors, and that's how we build a movement.
So there you go.
Take action.
Yeah, and the movement's happening. The movement had a great victory last night, and congratulations, Elena. Thanks so much for being with us tonight, or this morning.
Thank you so much.
This afternoon, whatever it is. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Joshua Holland. He's on the ground in Oakland for the Occupy Wall Street National Strike today. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with us. By the way, at the top of the hour, Dom Eratzarena Erotazina. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. We'll find out when we get him on the phone. But he's the president of the Oakland Police Association. And they've got an open letter to the mayor and to the citizens of Oakland out there, and they want to tell their story. So the question, with the police violence of last week, were the police just following orders? And if so, does that absolve them or condemn them or congratulate them? I mean, you know, in regard to the police violence in Oakland, is it okay? Is it a symptom of something larger? Curious your thoughts on that. We'll pick up your calls after the bottom of the hour, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Right now, Joshua Holland is on the line with us. He is a writer and editor at Alternet.org, senior writer and editor at Alternet.org, the author of the 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy and Everything Else the Right Doesn't Want You to Know About Taxes, Jobs, and Corporate America, which is a brilliant book. Joshua, welcome.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
At first, I thought that voice was you. Oh, man.
As you can hear in the background, there's some speeches going on. This is near the encampment in front of City Hall, where this has been going down for the last month. And that may be Angela Davis. I've stepped a block away to get a little distance, and I'm not sure who's speaking. But there's a rather large crowd that's spilled into the middle of the street. There's a lot of people here. I think that we're waiting for the first demonstration of the day to get underway.
Okay, so set the scene for us. Where are you, or where were you, and what's going on there, and what is anticipated for the day today in Oakland? It is now, you know, nine in the morning and change. It's the beginning of the day in Oakland.
That's right. I think they're still getting underway. I can tell you that I see a number of businesses closed. It's certainly not the case that all of Oakland is participating in this so-called general strike. But I think that we're seeing a lot of people approaching. I mean, there's lines of people streaming in right now. And I have a feeling this is going to be a large day of demonstrations with a lot of attention on them, if not an actual general strike in the traditional sense.
Now, the mayor has, and in fact, as you heard in my setup here, the president of the Oakland Police Officers Association is going to drop by in our next hour. And the mayor has come out and said that she supports the general strike, but she wants all the police officers to be on duty today. She's canceled all vacation leave, all sick duty, blah, 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 blah. If you're a cop, you're working today. Is this a bit of a mixed message?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of politics going on here, Tom. This is a very, you know, progressive community. The violence last week was not well received. There's been a lot of backlash. And it seems to me that everybody's scrambling to deflect blame from themselves. So we had the chief of police giving a very self-serving press conference. I can tell you that having been there, his account of what happened on Tuesday night was not accurate. Well, the police chief went and gave a press conference in which he said his officers were being pelted with rocks and bottles, and it was only because they were afraid for officer safety that they deployed these massive volleys of tear gas, flashbang grenades, and less lethal projectiles. I was here watching it with my own eyes. And while I saw a few plastic water bottles, certainly thrown at police in very heavy riot gear, you know, there is an idea that police responses should be proportional and at a very minimal. It was not an act of self-defense, as the chief said. So what we have is a lot of people here trying to, you know, blame others because of the negative attention that last Tuesday's event has brought on the city. So Jean Kwan, Mayor Kwan, you know, she said that she was out of town. She didn't know about it. It was a lower level city administrator that ordered the eviction of Occupy Oakland, which started this all.
Has that person been fired or prosecuted?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Has that person been fired or prosecuted or even identified?
yes, I don't remember the person's name. They have not been fired or prosecuted, but they have been identified. They took one. There was an assistant city manager who took one. In my interpretation, took one for the team,
yeah,
as they say, and took blame for it. I don't find that terribly credible. I don't have any evidence to demonstrate that Gene Kwan knew what was going on and ordered it, but it certainly doesn't seem a plausible story that the mayor of Oakland, after weeks of standoff, after giving all of these eviction notices and not enforcing it, just suddenly was out of town and some lower level person made that call.
You can kind of understand it if this was the 19th century and it had to cut, the information had to come by horse, by, you know, Pony Express from Oakland to Washington, D.C. But anybody in Oakland could have picked up the phone and called the mayor and said, what should we do? And she could have said, do it or don't do it. I you know, I'm baffled here.
And she's in a bad situation.
Oh, she's sitting in a sauna for 6 hours? I mean, I don't get it.
Well, frankly, I don't know that it looks terribly good to be out of touch, to not know what's going on. You know, right. I'm not sure if that's much better than ordering the actual crackdown. So, again, we see a political hot potato, and what do you do when you have a hot potato? You throw it at the next guy.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so you're going to keep us up to date on how things are going through the day, and we'll check in with you again tomorrow and see what happened today.
Yes, I expect a lively day of events. Definitely stay tuned towards 4, 5, 6 p.m. local time. Pacific time, yes. When they try to shut down the Port of Oakland, the fifth busiest container port in the United States.
Right, which would be around 7, 8, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. Okay, Joshua Holland, alternet.org. Joshua, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great talking with you. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
866-987-THOM. Is it the cops' fault, the mayor's fault, or the protesters' fault? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, did you know that there was a group of people who were plotting a biological attack using ricin, what the poison that killed all those people in the subways in Japan back years and years ago, that was busted by the FBI, terrorists, busted by the FBI on Tuesday? They were not Muslims. They were white guys. Therefore, it's not in the news. Very interesting. Sally in Oakland. Hey, Sally. Thanks for listening to Green 960. What's up?
Hi, Tom. So the city administrator is Deanna Santana. If you look on the Oakland City website, you can get the hierarchy. That attack had to have taken more than a week to plan because they used all the police forces of the entire Alameda County plus San Francisco police.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just not believable that Gene Kwan didn't know about it.
Yeah. And so Deanna Santana is the person who metaphorically took the bullet for the mayor. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, she's got the city administrator. The way our city is set up, the administrator has a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was down there the other day, that was the word that I was told, that she was the one who gave the call.
I see.
So that's it.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for the information, Sally. Good to hear from you, Steve in Philadelphia. Hey, Steve, Occupy Philadelphia.
Yes, hello, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm doing great.
Okay, so what's up?
Well, we passed our first amendment as a group in 24 days, and it was to...
You mean your first resolution from the General Assembly?
Yes.
Okay.
It was to repeal the constitutional amendment to eliminate corporate personhood.
Oh, that's great. Or to advance a constitutional amendment, you mean?
Right.
To put forward one that would repeal corporate personhood. Very, very good, Steve. You know, I'm seeing this as a theme increasingly. You're like the fifth or sixth, I think, General Assembly of the various Occupy movements around the country that has actually, by consensus, everybody agreeing, this whole idea that corporations are people and money is speech is nuts, and we need to do something about it. And
by the Occupyings actually coming out with this, we're actually bringing more attention and more people are becoming aware of it. I mean, a lot more people at Occupy Philly themselves became more aware of it. We had discussion groups and so forth before they did the final vote on the General Assembly, because it was set up initially, and then it was tabled so that people could get more information, and we actually gave them a lot of information, and a lot of people were a lot more informed.
That's great. That's great. And just a reminder, you can find more information on that. You can read my book on this online for free over at truthout.org. The book is called Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How We Can Fight Back. Steve, thank you. And please pass along my very best regards to everybody at Occupy Philadelphia, would you please?
Thank you very much. Nice to talk to you, Tom.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
Bye.
It's very interesting. It's very interesting. Oh, I mentioned and then we'll get back to your calls, but I mentioned the right wing terror attack, and I didn't say where. This is down in Georgia, four Georgia men who are believed to belong to a fringe militia groups. This has been reported over at Talking Point Memos, talkingpointmemo.com. An FBI confidential source recorded this thing. It was taken on, this meeting took place on St. Patrick's Day. The 73-year-old Frederick Thomas of Cleveland, 67-year-old Don Roberts, 65-year-old Ray Adams, 68-year-old Samuel Crump, all of Tokoka, Georgia. And, basically the plan was, well, actually it was based on a novel called Absolve, which is written by Mike Vanderbo, a right-wing blogger, former militiaman, I'm quoting here from the TPM article, who lives on government disability checks but hates the government, has been featured on Fox News in relation to the Fast and Furious scandal, and is on Congressman Representative Daryl Issa, one of the few criminals who's actually got elected as a member of Congress. On his press release distribution list, he has previously advocated on his blog Sipsy Street Irregulars for opponents to health care laws to throw bricks through the windows of Democratic members of Congress. And in reaction to these arrests, Vanderbo called them a geriatric militia, and he was skeptical of the charges. Right. Colleen in Sebastopol, California. Hey, Colleen. What's up?
Hey there, Tom. Wonderful news. Occupy Santa Rosa decided they wanted to camp, and the city administration decided they would allow them until they could have the full council take a look. And all the council members, even conservative except for one, decided that they can continue to camp peacefully. We got this through by the people. They're occupying City Hall and working with the officials. We have got our free speech in Santa Rosa. It's wonderful to counter what happened in Oakland with showing a way that it worked.
Now, do I understand this right, that initially the city said fine until we talked to the city council, and then the city council decided that's fine with us with the exception of one vote? Is that right? So it's like officially fine now?
Absolutely. It was a huge victory, and the people who are occupying are being really stellar in how they're respecting the City Hall property and how they're dealing with the people who are troublemakers, with their own little noble police force.
Right.
And I'm helping to educate them about the power of using their voice with their elected officials to get what they want instead of just protesting on the street. You know, you work with the elected officials.
You do both. It's got to be, as Tim Carpenter of PDAmerica.org says, we need an outside game and an inside game, both. And there are some great folks on the outside, Code Pink and those folks, and there's some great folks on the inside, the Democratic Party. But if we don't do both, we're never going to have a really progressive movement within our government.
And part of their inside movement is they have the ACLU parked in there as well, camping with them. So there's a close eye being watched, and they know that.
That's great.
So here's my suggestion, is that all the Occupies work on a political action committee of constitutional candidates for peace, those who pledge to uphold their oath to the Constitution without waiver and doing no harm, sticking to just no offense in the Department of Defense budget.
Right.
And the candidates who pledge that will be on this list. And then the voters who pledge to only vote for those candidates, we can be making these demands now that they take action if they want to keep their seats or face a recall.
Right.
And we
can say this is basically an anti-war position.
Well, but
turning the Department of Defense into a true defense.
Well, I'm saying social and environmental justice for all.
Okay.
For ourselves and the way we treat our Earth neighbors.
Yeah.
And if we have these political action committees that are nonpartisan, that people can get what they want. And if we make this simple, an action list of five with your thumb on top, that's the one thing the anti-war, anti-unconstitutional war, we say this is more important than the rest. We'll get to the rest at next. But we start using our debt money to kill others without due process. It's not okay.
Yeah.
And it makes us less safe at home when we're laying off cops, sheriffs. We don't have our National Guard here. So if we say to the candidates, if you want these jobs, show us your action plan to deliver this specifically. And then the people, you know, the Occupy movement can go and infiltrate the elections in a way like never, ever before. So start with your city hall, your board of supervisors, your state capitol, and every elected official's office until they are giving into these we won't say demands, but we insist that this change happen, or we're going to stay here as a vigil on your city hall, on your lawn, in your city council at public comment time until you're delivering these results.
Mm.
So they'll get it. Elections will change so the people can be lobbyists and it'll work.
Yep, you're absolutely right. People have to become lobbyists because, you know, organized people, I believe, over time will win against organized money. Right now, organized money has the high ground, has the high power. And it's just amazing. Organized people across the country are starting to wake up and push back. Colleen, thank you for the call, and thank you for the great work you're doing there. John in Ferndale, Washington. Hey, John, what's up?
Tom, great show as always. One correction for you. You said that the attacks by those yahoos down south there
planned
the same
attacks
as the Tokyo attacks. Yeah, they used sarin gas, if you recall, in Tokyo. And that is a neurotoxin. It's a
gas. You're right. I'm mixing up sarin and ricin.
Mixing up ricin is derived from the castor bean, and it's it can be aerosolized. And but that was you know and but how
yeah.
they planned on doing it.
Yeah.
They're both
deadly poisons though.
Deadly poison, and it doesn't make any difference. But just to be clear.
Thank you.
I also want to tell everyone in every single Occupy movement. It doesn't matter what the police do or how they dress. There is never an excuse to throw a water bottle. And you know, I realize, oh, it's just a water bottle.
Right.
But it's like, we can't give these guys any excuse.
Yes.
To, you know, we have to be virtuous on our side.
Nonviolence is nonviolence. And throwing a water bottle is a form of violence.
Yeah, and I just wonder, Tom, when is President Obama, he didn't give us any support in Wisconsin as far as physically?
Well, he actually, you know, he did show up in Madison
there
and gave a speech. But I think that strategically, not from his point of view, you know, but from Wisconsin's point of view, it was a good thing he stayed out of there. Because had he gone to Wisconsin and done a rah, 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 it would have turned into do you love or hate Obama. And as it was, it stayed as a do you love or hate, you know, the Fitz Walker Stan agenda, which is really where it needed to stay focused.
Yeah.
But at a national level, now this thing has gone national, I would love to hear from the president on it, too, as well.
He has to get out in front of it.
Okay.
He has to get out in front of this rolling wave, or it'll wash over him.
Well, that's typically how it works, John, and that's sort of the bad news and the good news, is the politicians very rarely lead waves. They almost always follow them. But once they start following them, then those waves take on tremendous power. We'll see how this one plays out. Thanks for the call, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the Republicans on the Gang of 12. You'll recall the Democrats came out with their proposal a couple of days ago. Raise $1 trillion in taxes. Republicans want to cut a little. I'll tell you about that.
Which side are you on, Mike? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
All right, so what are the two sides here? I find this fascinating. The attempts to rewrite history. You know, at Reagan National Airport this week, $900,000 was spent. Just think, you know, how all the good things that could have been done with that money to erect a massive bronze statue of Ronald Reagan at the airport here in Washington, D.C. That was yesterday or the day before. And it's part of this campaign, this very well-funded, multi-hundred million dollar over the years campaign that's been going on ever since Reagan left the White House, called the Reagan Legacy Campaign or Movement, one or the other, that is to reinvent his legacy. to give us amnesia about the biggest stock market crash in 1987 during his presidency in the history of the 20th century, with the exception of 1929, up until, of course, the Bush crash. And they were both basically caused by the same thing, Reaganomics. To forget about the two big recessions that Reagan brought us through, to forget about the fact that Reagan tripled the deficit, to forget about the fact that Reagan raised taxes on working people about a dozen times. I mean, just all this stuff, just completely reinvent him as a saint. And now they're trying, in a very similar fashion, you know, reinventing history. The banksters got deregulated with Graham Leach Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and the banksters went out to pretty much anybody who had a pulse and said, we'll sell you a mortgage. By 2006, Fannie and Freddie were pretty much out of the business. There was a law passed during the back, I think actually the first iteration of it was during the Carter administration, but you know, Community Reinvestment Act, that basically said that it's illegal for banks to redline. In other words, you can't say no to somebody on a mortgage based on where they live. Because it used to be banks would say, you know, okay, this entire neighborhood, not a good neighborhood. We're not going to make any loans there. Now you've got to look at the individual. But if the individual has the money and has the income and can afford to buy the house, then, you know, by the standards of good banking practice, in other words, you can't discriminate based on neighborhood. That's all it was. The Republicans have turned this into the boogeyman, into the villain in the whole giant economic housing crash thing. And here's Mayor Bloomberg repeating this lie. It's just a plain old flat-out lie. Here it is.
I hear your complaints. Some of them are totally unfounded. It was not the banks that created the mortgage crisis. It was plain and simple Congress who forced everybody to go and to give mortgages to people who were on the cusp. Now, I'm not so sure that was terrible policy, because a lot of those people who got homes still have them, and they wouldn't have had them without that. But they were the ones that pushed Fannie and Freddie to make a bunch of loans that were imprudent, if you will. They were the ones that pushed the banks to loan to everybody. And now we want to go vilify the banks because it's one target. It's easy to blame them, and Congress certainly isn't going to blame themselves.
Now, this is a lie. You got a billionaire mayor of New York City, who's lying. And Mayor Bloomberg, I'm on the air in your city on WWRL. If I am lying about you lying, you are welcome to come on this program. Well, whether or not, you're welcome to come on this program and refute it. Or have any of your employees or spokespeople or whatever refute it. But you can't, because what you just said is a lie. There's not a single bankster in America who was forced to give a subprime mortgage to anybody. Not one. And not only that, according to the Federal Reserve, it was the private mortgage brokers, not Fannie and Freddie, who drove the subprime housing bubble. More than 84% of all the subprime mortgages in 2006, the peak year of the bubble, 84% issued by private lending institutions. This wasn't the government. Private firms made nearly 83% of the subprime loans to low and moderate income borrowers that year. And again, they weren't forced to do it. They did it because it was profitable, because they could take They could take the money that they made on a $100,000, $200,000 mortgage and slice and dice that into CDOs and CDSs and double bets and triple bets and all these kinds of things, and turn it into hundreds of billions of dollars, or, you know, an individual one, into billions of dollars worth of collateralized debt obligations, and then bets on them and bets against them that could be then sold to pension funds all across the United States, which is why so many of them are in trouble. To states around which is why so many of them are in trouble, to countries like Greece. I mean, you know, you had Goldman Sachs helping, you know, basically doing these reverse swaps with Greece so that they could push their debt out into the future at a nice fee for Goldman Sachs. And then Greece also still owed the money plus the interest, so that they could get their debt as a percentage of GDP below the 3% necessary to get into the EU. So Goldman entering into a conspiracy with Greece, which has now blown up in the face of Greece. Goldman's doing just fine. They got their money and ran. And so then a bunch of other European banks came in and said, okay, well, we'll loan you the money to Greece. Now the Goldman's backed out of this thing. And now they're all freaked out because the Greek people are saying, yeah, maybe we're not going to pay this. So anyhow, we'll see. Anyhow, a couple of quick questions. Or a couple of quick callers here. Melanie in Seattle. Hey, Melanie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Fine.
Good. Yeah, I just wanted to make an announcement for anybody listening in Seattle and surrounding areas. There is going to be an Occupy Seattle rally, okay, that is going to happen this evening, and it is targeted or rallying against Jamie Dimon, CEO of Chase Bank. He is going to be speaking to University of Washington business school attendees, and, you know, God knows what the topic would be.
Right.
Oh, I think it might be about leadership, okay? And this rally is really against, you know, the type of leadership that, you know, his brand of leadership. So
right.
It gets started at Westlake Park at 6. From there, at some point, they're going to march just, you know, down the streets to the Sheraton Hotel.
Right.
And that is on 6th and Pine.
Okay. And
so
this is at what time?
Starts at 6.
Okay. Starts at 6. Great. And you said, so people can, go ahead.
So people can just, you know, gather around Westlake Park and then march and rally to the rally.
Great.
In front of the Sheraton.
Melanie, thank you very much for the announcement. And,
you're welcome. Thank
check,
you.
Check it out, folks. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Dom Aratzarena is with us. Sir, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah, that's right. Aratzarena.
Great. You are the president of the Oakland Police Officers Association. OPOA.org is the website. And I understand you crafted this letter that is on your website that says, that starts out, we represent the 645 police officers who work hard every day to protect the citizens of Oakland. We, too, are the 99% fighting for better working conditions, fair treatment, and the ability to provide a living for our children and our families. We are severely understaffed, with many city beats remaining unprotected by police during the day and evening hours. And then goes on from there to essentially criticize the mayor for putting you guys in the position where what is described as a police riot happened Tuesday night. Is all that accurate up to this point?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So what... First of all, what's the position? What's your position? The position of the Oakland Police Officers Association on what happened Tuesday night? I mean, what could possibly justify the use of tear gas? They arrested 700 people on the Brooklyn Bridge. They didn't need tear gas to do that.
You know, I wasn't out there the night of the riot, so I can't explain why the, you know, justification was made to utilize, you know, tear gas. But you know, from what I understand, there was a lot of rocks and bottles being thrown at police officers, and
talked to a reporter earlier who was there, who said that yes, there were a few protesters who were throwing plastic water bottles that they had been drinking at the police, which I think we all deplore. But does that really justify rubber bullets, which can, you know, if they hit you in the right place, kill you or take your eye out, flash grenades and tear gas?
You know, I can't even get into why they did what they did, because I wasn't out there at that time.
Okay. And the Oakland Police Officers Association is not taking a position on that.
No, we're not going to criticize or get into the discussion about the tactics used that night, because we quite frankly, I was not there.
Were those tactics, the decision to use those tactics, were those made on the spot by the police officers? Were those made by the mayor's office? I mean, much of your letter points out, and I think this is one of the things that you know, from the Vietnam era to today, that particularly when people think of, you know, people who might be opposed to foreign wars or supportive of them for that matter, that it's not the soldiers. I mean, there's a few bad apples in every group, right? We can all acknowledge that, but typically it's not the soldiers who are responsible for the war. It's not, generally speaking, the police department that is responsible for the action that they're taking. It's the civilian government. This is the greatness of America, that our military and our police are under the jurisdiction of the civilian that ordered it. And this, it sounds to me like in your letter, you're basically saying, Mayor Kwan, you know, what the hell's going on here?
So you're right. I mean, you're hitting the nail on the head when you talk about, you know, these are police officers. They're just doing their job. You know, we kind of feel like we've been placed in this really bad position of a no-win situation. And we've been silent the whole time on this issue, and then the media and the politicians have just kind of painted the picture and putting us on an island, which is very unfair to the police officers, especially the men and women that represent the Oakland Police Department. They've been depicted poorly, and it doesn't represent how, you know, what we do here. This is the city of Oakland. We have a tough, high crime rate. These are hard-nosed police officers that have to deal with stuff every day, and our main focus is community policing and to deal with issues within the community, working with the community, not because the community policing, quote unquote, like that's the right thing to do. It's because we have to do it. We don't have that many cops. We need to have the citizens help us. So that's who we are.
As the president of the Oakland Police Officers Association, is this a union or is this a non-union organization?
This is an association. It's not unionized. It's not like
Are you guys unionized?
We are an association only.
Okay, so there's not the Oakland Police Department is not part of the Teamsters
no,
or the AFL-CIO or anything like that.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Just curious. What do you say to the folks who say, you know, when police violence happens and people say, "I was just following orders"? We heard that song back in the 40s, and nobody took it seriously after the fact. In fact, some people got hung for that. Obviously, the scale was wildly different, but it's just something that doesn't fly with Americans generally. I mean, you've got a guy in the hospital with brain damage as a result of the violence that was perpetrated by the Oakland Police Department.
Okay, so what is my response to all of that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's all of one thing, isn't it, basically?
Well, quite simply is this. My question is, how do we get there? I mean, how do we get to this spot? I mean, more importantly than the act itself, what caused us to get to where we were?
Right.
And that's where, if you look, that's where the mistakes are occurring.
Sure.
We should have never got to this location. We should have never been in this position, and the police should have never been placed in this type of position.
And there are police departments around the country that are actually refusing to do it. I believe it was Philadelphia. It might have been Pittsburgh the day before, or perhaps it was the day after last week that you guys had your problem in Oakland, that where the mayor said, you know, go in and clear the park, and the police chief said no. You know, I know policing.
I mean, yeah, now you got politics playing in everything now. See,
yeah.
So now everyone saw us, and they're like, oh, we're not, you know, we don't want to get, you know, on the political spotlight like Oakland did, and you saw everyone pulling out.
Right.
Now, unfortunately for everybody, you know, that now these things have taken blossomed into something else, and everyone's going to have to deal with this at some point. And the only problem that, and the reason why we wrote the letter is that we're not trying to completely criticize all what we do. We are just trying to say, hey, look, we're just trying to do our job out here. We should be looked at as just, you know, public servants that are just doing what we're told to do. You know,
but when people are exercising their First Amendment right to peaceably assemble and petition the government for redress of grievance, which is, you know, right there in the First Amendment, and somebody shows up and shoots them with a rubber bullet, which can kill.
Do you think this is the first protest we've had in Oakland? No, we got them all the time. We've had protests here all the time, and not a situation, not a attention like this.
Right. So why this? Why now?
It's about how we got here. It's about what prompted us to get to this position. I think there was a lot of poor tactics in how the city
was
approaches.
Was the police department directed to be there in the way at the level of force and given the permission to escalate to the level of force that they did? By civilian officials, by Deanna Santana, or by Gene Kwan, the mayor, or was there a more general order, like clear the park, and all those decisions were made by the police?
I think there was a more general order, and then things were carried out by the police department.
Okay, so that sounds to me like really an indictment of your internal policies at the police department.
Well, I don't know. I'm not gonna. I mean, you're talking about something that, you know, you weren't there. I wasn't there. We don't know what was. You're going off secondhand information.
Well, I'm going off a guy in the hospital. You know,
and
I'm just saying.
Yeah,
somebody screwed up.
I guess you failed to mention that there's seven police officers that are injured as well. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Okay,
and
7 police officers were injured.
What were they injured by?
The day. They were hit by rocks and bottles, feces, paint were thrown at them.
Any of them hospitalized?
No, they were not hospitalized. Okay. But let me ask you a question. At what point do we say no to that?
Well, I would say no to that from the get-go.
At what point do police officers become just active targets to people and then we just take it? I mean,
well, you don't. You shouldn't. And you shouldn't have to. I'm with you on that. But, and I would say that this is the lesson that every movement needs to learn, is to look at what Martin Luther King and those folks did down in Selma when they stood there and the police turned dogs on them and turned fire hoses on them, and they didn't throw a rock. They stood there and took it. And that demonstrated a moral high ground, as it were. And I think everybody needs to be claiming the moral high ground right now. Dom, I'm sorry, we're out of time. The machine starts. I don't start it.
Well, I mean, before I leave you,
sure.
You have a discussion on how you would handle this differently, okay?
Okay, yeah, that's a very, very good conversation. Thank you, Dom Aratz.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dom Aratz Arena, who is the head of the OPOA.org, the Oakland Police Officers Association. Thank you, sir.
What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Curtis Sliwa on the line with us, the talk show host in New York City, and his show is from 5 to 9 a.m. weekdays on AM 970. The Apple, the anti-crime activist, founder of the Guardian Angels, and still the CEO of the Guardian Angels. Curtis, welcome back to the program.
Oh, my pleasure, and Tom, I'm so happy that I've escaped the wrath of the 99% in Zuccotti Park, because I don't know if you know, I actually fit a unique category. I'm a 2%er. When I'm in Starbucks paying $5 for a burnt cup of coffee, I ask for 2% milk, so I escape, right?
Curtis, your phone is breaking up really, really badly. Are you on a cell phone?
Yeah. Did you give me a call back?
Yeah, we'll call you right back. Let me just drop this and whoops, I didn't drop it. I will drop it, and we'll call you right back because it's hard to hear you. But we just had the president of the Oakland Police Officers Association on, and he's but here's this is the thing that I wanted to discuss with Curtis. A video of an Occupy Wall Street protester being allegedly punched in the face by a member of the New York PD has gone viral, and here we go. There, Curtis, you back?
Oh, I'm back.
Sounds
much better. I almost choked on that $5 cup of burnt coffee from Starbucks.
Okay, here's what I don't get. From what I'm reading of your take on all this, that you share Occupy Wall Street's goals, that is, stop having America be ripped off by the banksters. Do I have that right?
Oh, not only that, I want the daisy chain walk, perp walk, for not DSK, but for John Corzine and Geithner and every other crook on Wall Street, whether they're Republican, Democrat, or independent.
Okay. I think we can, although all you named was Democrats, I think that we can kind of share that goal. Why is it then that you are supporting, instead of supporting the Occupy Wall Street movement, you're supporting the Tea Party? And the Tea Party congressmen have been voting very, very consistently to give more protections to those banksters, more immunity to those banksters, more tax breaks to those banksters, and basically saying to the average working stiff, hey, screw you.
Well, notice, Tom, that wasn't the original for the Tea Party. In fact, that happened once they got co-opted by the Republicans and conservatives. So Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Atlanta, Occupy Belly Button Land, wherever you may be out there, just know this is what happens when you get co-opted by the powers to be. So in this case, the big strong unions and the Democrats, the DNC, could do the same to you, because I spoke at the AARP meeting out in Las Vegas at the Venetian Casino. This is where Herman Cain made his debut originally, when nobody knew who Herman Cain was. And I spoke about locking up all the bankers and all the crooks on Wall Street and how no one had ever been indicted or convicted of a crime committed when they virtually impaired all of us due to their stealing, their whining, dining, and pocket lining in 2008. And I got a standing ovation.
No, wouldn't we both? But you are on your radio program, you're basically trashing the Occupy Wall Street folks. And you know, back in the day, you were one of the champions of going up against institution power and empowering local citizens. And here you got local citizens standing up saying, you know, we're opposed to this institutional power that's ripping us off. And you're sounding like grandpa yelling, get off my lawn.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, look, I grew up in the era of Woodstock, and boy, that was a pigsty there, right? No Port of Sands, peace, love, happiness, urination, defecation, copulation, and fornication. So know that, Tom. I can accept that. But what has happened with Occupy Wall Street is that they're all over the map. Every other day, it's a different issue. They need to stay focused. How many times they've been away
Who
from
Who says they need to stay focused? There's all kinds of problems in this country, Curtis.
Excuse me?
There's all kinds of problems with this country. Who says that they need to stay focused? Actually, the resolutions that I've been hearing out of five of them now are that they're saying that we should pass a constitutional amendment saying that speech isn't money. Money isn't speech, and corporations aren't people. Aren't you on board with that?
Yeah, but they're not into free speech because now all of a sudden that you have the homeless, the poor, the destitute, those who are mentally impaired joining their ranks. You notice the words that some of them are using? We don't need these slackers, these gold bricks, these miscreants. I've heard words attributed to Occupy Wall Streeters that would normally be...
Actually, I've had the Occupy Wall Streeters on, and the police are...
About street people.
The police are feeding the street people down into there, and the Occupy Wall Streeters are now actually trying to create liaisons with local organizations that can deal with schizophrenics and alcoholics. That's not their thing. Their thing is speaking to politics. And you know, I get it. You're with the establishment now. What about this police violence? I just was talking with the president of the Oakland Police Officers Association, and he said that basically the idea to use the tear gas, the rubber bullets, and all that kind of stuff in Oakland was not an order from the mayor. It was not an order from the civilians. It was a decision made by the police department themselves. How long
to see them use it on the Bloods and Crips out there, the Norteños and Sereños. That might do the community a lot better service. But look, Tom, let's look at Atlanta, right? The city of civil rights. Martin Luther King Jr. has his stamp all over that city from the time you take a plane to Hartsdale Airport and you walk around. Yet notice, the Atlanta Police Department, on the orders of the mayor and the city council, a predominantly black power leadership, moved in and completely took apart the encampment in Occupy Atlanta. Now, how is it that they're able to do that in the civil rights city? No complaints. Because
so you're trying to turn this into a racial issue?
And all of a sudden, you're pointing to Oakland and other cities where it hasn't necessarily gone as smoothly as it did in Atlanta.
You're trying to turn this into a racial issue?
Oh, well, come on. Let's face it. The 99% in Zuccotti Park originally were mostly all white. All of a sudden, you get street people who are black and Hispanic in there, and the privileged white kids living on trust funds with baby pins stuck to every orifice of their body with green hair, blue hair.
Curtis, I'm so sorry to hear you talking like this.
I'm a little uncomfortable.
I'm so sorry to hear you talking like this. I thought the Guardian Angels,
they're stop defecating and urinating, copulating and fornicating, and they may have more supporters.
Yeah, I get it. I got your rap, Curtis. Thanks a lot for being with us. CurtisSliwa.com. You can read all
You're
about
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the defenders of the people become the defenders of the establishment. Amazing. Here with you, Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman Program, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Ed in Klamath Falls. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I've watched the Oakland police and I read their statement on TV that they don't understand how the mayor's telling them which side of the skirmish line to stand on.
Right.
I think that they need to understand that skirmish line implies a minor encounter in a war. They are not warriors. They are peace officers. And I believe that if they would act like peace officers, no one would throw bottles or rocks at them because we're Americans. We treat police officers with respect, peace officers.
Generally speaking.
They're not the Army. That's why the Army doesn't like to get involved in citizen actions.
Right, and until Bush came along, it was actually illegal. We had this thing called the Posse Comitatus Act, which made it a crime for the Army to turn their guns on American citizens, civilians, although that was done away with the Military Appropriations Act in, what, 2006 or 2007. But so now it's legal for the military to shoot at us as well as police officers. But, okay, excellent point, Ed. Anyway, Jim in Milwaukee. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You had, during the, while you were announcing the news bits, you mentioned the fact that the Super Committee was looking at $800 and some billion worth of tax cuts.
For billionaires and millionaires, yeah.
Presumably the idea is, you know, the old idea that the tax cuts would encourage consumer spending, more investment by employers, and as a result, we create more jobs, and those jobs would result in more taxes, and that would resolve the deficit problem.
Right.
Well, I happen to be one of those strange people who loves to do statistics. In fact, as a retiree, that's what my job was for 30-some years. So I was curious, and I downloaded some information from the OMB and as well as from the Department of Labor Statistics. And here's what I came up with. Now, these figures are all based upon the 2010 federal fiscal year. Now, in 2010, the feds took in a total of $2.2 trillion in revenues. And of that amount, 36% came from payroll taxes, and 45% came from individual income taxes.
Right.
So that's basically all worker-related revenue.
Right.
Now, if you divide that, that comes to $1.75 trillion. You divide that by the current U.S. workforce of 154 million, that comes out to about $11,400 per worker. Now, our deficit in 2010 was $1.43 trillion. In order to determine how many new jobs you'd have to create, in order to resolve that deficit of $1.43 trillion, you divide...
you divide that by 11,000, yeah.
Right, right.
But
that comes to 126 million new jobs.
Right.
Now, if you add that...
Which ain't going to happen.
54, it can't, because there's not that many...
Well, this is the problem with doing these kinds of averages, means, medians, or averages, Jim. I mean, you know, you got nine guys in a bar who all make $25,000 a year. Bill Gates walks in. Suddenly, the average wealth of everybody in that bar is, what, $3 billion?
Right.
So, this is why when you look at average income in the United States, it's radically higher than median income in the United States because of the fact that the top 1% has seen a 275% pay increase since Ronald Reagan came into office, and the bottom 60 or 80% has seen basically bupkis. And in fact, the bottom 20, 30, 40% has seen their wages go down since Ronald Reagan came into office. And their taxes go up. In fact, the payroll tax was doubled since Ronald Reagan came into office.
Well, in fact, in order for that kind of federal revenue to be coming in, every single worker in this country would have to be making, on average, $46,000 a year.
Yeah. Well, and again, the word average is the devil in the details. But there are a few. You know, if you want to do that kind of math, here's a couple of simple solutions you might want to look at. Number one. Lower the retirement age for Social Security from 65 to 55. That immediately, assuming 50% of the people who are now eligible for Social Security actually take it, and the other half stay in the workforce, then what you have done is you have now opened up 10, 11 million, I forget the number now, but it's in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. You've opened up a whole bunch of new jobs. Your unemployment rate basically goes to zero. All these young people coming into the workforce, they now have jobs. They're now paying income. You tighten the labor market, which increases the demand for labor, which increases wages, which increases tax collections. And these people now are paying into the system rather than taking money out of it. So the system actually becomes more profitable. And this is what France did when they took the work week from 40 hours down to 35 hours. And what they found was it decreased unemployment by a point and a half, and which is why they did it. And, you know, because companies had to hire more people to get the same job done. And I think that this, you know, that's one very elegant way to do it. The other would be to raise the minimum wage to where it would be if it was in 1965 inflation adjusted dollars, which would be around $13 an hour. Just tomorrow, raise the minimum wage to where it used to be when Jack Kennedy was president. And you know, suddenly you've got a lot of people making a little bit more, and that little bit more translates into higher tax revenues. So, Jim, excellent statistical analysis. Thank you for it. Michael in San Rafael, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I love all the work you're doing. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Just
all
fine.
All right. My perspective is that for this movement, the Occupy movement, to really flower into something long-lasting and good for everyone, we should remember, we meaning everyone involved, that the 1% are made up of individuals who are playing out the role of wealthy people at this point in time. But intrinsically, we're all the same spiritually. And, you know, they're, it's almost like I think they know that that lifestyle, even though they are winning the game, so to speak, is not bringing lasting
change. The latest poll that was done last week showed that 63% of people who have an income of over $1 million think that they should pay higher taxes. So 63% of the top part of the 1% are saying, yes, raise our taxes. This, you know, obviously the Republicans in Congress are not hearing this because they're listening to the Koch brothers and all of the various Koch brothers enterprises, from the Federalist Society to Cato Institute to Heritage to all the talking heads that these guys put out to the ALEC and on and on and on and on. You know, the Koch brothers have helped build this incredible infrastructure along, and not alone. I mean, you know, Joe Kors, who's now deceased, helped, and Richard Mellon Scaife, who's still passing out money, and Reverend Moon has lost about $2 billion, donated about $2 billion to the cause. And on it goes. But you're right. The top 1% are not, A, they're not evil, and B, they're not homogenous. It's not a homogenous block. In fact, you know, some of the top 1% are very good, very philanthropic people who are doing good work. It's about the rules of the game. And that's what we need to be looking at, is the rules of the game. Congress defines the rules of the game. And if you look at just, you know, core, basic, rational statistics, whenever the top tax on millionaires and billionaires goes above 50%. Now, this doesn't affect average working people, and it doesn't even affect millionaires on their first, you know, whatever, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $1 million. It doesn't affect them on that. But when they start making their second million, third million, fourth million, in the case of John Paulson last year, his fourth or fifth billion, they start paying, you know, 50, 60, 70% income tax. When that happens, the economy stabilizes and you don't have bubbles. When you do away with that and you drop that top tax rate below 50% like Ronald Reagan did in 1985, what year, 86, what you see is immediately an economy will emerge that is a bubble-driven economy, and it will stay that way until you raise that top tax rate. So it's, you know, it's very, very simple, very straightforward. Steve in Portland. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, so there's somebody called and said the chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase was coming to Seattle.
Yes, Jamie Morgan, Jamie Dimon. Today.
Jamie Dimon, yeah, he's also coming to Portland.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's going to talk to the Portland Business Alliance. They're having a little lunch meeting there at the Hilton Executive Tower Grand Ballroom, mm-hmm. and it's conveniently located two blocks away from Occupy Portland.
Okay, well, you got the word out, Steve. Thank you very much for that. And give us a call tomorrow and let us know how it all worked out, would you?
All right, thank you.
Okay, good talking with you. Leslie in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Leslie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Couple of different things in the time on hold that you've covered that make me go, wow.
Yeah, please pick one, though.
Okay, my main reason for calling was I realize I have a great appreciation for the Occupy movement, and just to see what it's done with Bank of America and them not taking away, charging that monthly fee for the debit card usage and things like that. It's very powerful.
Right.
But I'm curious to know is that the members of Congress are the metaphoric fox guarding the hen house. How do we actually change that? How do we change the schematics of things? Because the congressional members are the ones that benefit the most from...
Right. In fact, Congress overall saw their wealth increase by 25% last year, and
yes.
90% of that increase went to the top 40 members, most of whom are Republicans, very, very wealthy. Number two is Darrell Issa, one of the only criminals also, former criminals, who's also in the House of Representatives. But the bottom line is that we need to say, we need to, this is a doctrine that did not come out of the legislature, did not come out of the White House at any time in the history of this nation. In fact, both have spoken against it over and over again. It came out of the Supreme Court. And it's the doctrine that corporations are people and that speech is money, or money is speech. And it needs to be repudiated, and the only way effectively and quickly to repudiate it is to pass a constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not speech. And it was passed as a resolution last night in Boulder, Colorado, and next week it's going to be up in Missoula, Montana, and other communities need to do the same. MoveToAmend.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And let me just say that one more time. MoveToAmend.org for information on how to do what the city of Boulder did last night. God bless them. It's great.
Well, hard times here, babe. Hard times everywhere I go.
So I find this fascinating. By the way, I was ranting about how yesterday Boulder, 73-point-something% of the good citizens of Boulder voted to end corporate personhood, to encourage Congress to pass a constitutional amendment saying corporations aren't people, money is not speech. Now, a number of members of Congress have actually put forward an amendment. This was this morning or yesterday afternoon, perhaps, and It's kind of halfway there, maybe 10% of the way there, but it's in the right direction. Tom Udall of New Mexico, Michael Bennett of Colorado, Tom Harkin of Iowa, Dick Durbin of Illinois, Chuck Schumer of New York, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, and Jeff Merkley of Oregon. I salute you all. And if I just called out one of your senators, please call their office and thank them. They introduced a constitutional amendment that would effectively overturn Citizens United. Now, it doesn't say corporations aren't people. It wouldn't strip corporate power in the United States, which I think we really need to do. And it doesn't say money isn't speech. Well, arguably, actually, it does. What it says is Congress has the power to regulate money in political campaigns. And this, you know, by amending the Constitution this way, basically, this is how you take on the Supreme Court. So it's a good step. This is a good step. Now, you know, my personal opinion is you're probably only going to get one shot with a constitutional amendment. Why not go for the whole thing, right? Why not order the folly, you know, the whole the meal with all the pieces in it? Why not order why not say corporations are not people, money is not speech, period? Big mistake back in 1886 when the court theoretically said that when the 14th Amendment said persons, it meant both natural persons and artificial persons. Why not do that? But at the very least, they're going to say, you know, corporate money is a corrosive influence in government, and that's a good one. John in Bush, Alaska. Hey, John, thanks for watching. What's up?
Good morning. I was just calling because I saw that the fellow from Oakland had the good sense to call you to get advice on how to do his job. And
actually, we called him.
Well, he asked you what to do. So,
oh, I see.
As a former Marine in Guantanamo, I was trained in crowd control.
Mm-hmm.
You maintain your lines. You have a snatch team. You have a troublemaker. The snatch team goes out, grabs him, and you bring him back.
Well, and in fact, I thought about saying that to him. You know, if somebody's throwing something at you, you go out and arrest them.
You snatch him.
Right, you snatch him.
And you have evidence.
Yeah.
And
you videotape it aggressively. So there's no doubt about it.
They turn the police into a military occupational force.
Yeah.
Outside of the Constitution.
Yeah.
They've made them immune for their actions, even when you catch them on videotape. And the people who are the 1%, I'm afraid, have killed millions of people to get where they're at. And they're not going to give it up.
Yeah. They're not going to give it up without a fight. And this is
going to be a fight.
This is where yesterday was the
75th.
Yeah, yesterday was the 75th. And thank you for the call and for pointing that out. Yesterday was the 75th anniversary of Franklin Roosevelt saying, you know, they hate me and I welcome their hatred. And that's what we need again. Rhonda in Fresno. Hey, Rhonda, what's up?
Hi. I was just saying, I just think of, about Oakland, that the police had no business there. What were they doing there? I don't understand.
They had been ordered by the mayor's office and Deanna Santana, apparently, the city administrator, has been the person that the mayor is pinning this on, to clear the park or to clear the area.
Okay. I know that, but what right did they have to give that order? I mean, the park is public property.
They
weren't damaging anything.
Yeah, So here's the question. Should the police have said, as they have in some cities around the United States, should they have said to the mayor, no, we're not going to do that? Or should they have done what the mayor says, because that's their job description, is to do what the mayor says?
No, you cannot go. There is no defense, and I was just following orders. I mean, we hanged a bunch of Nazis for that defense. So,
yeah.
You know.
But that's what we just heard from the head of the Oakland Police
and
Officers Association.
And I am sympathetic with the fact that he is very understaffed.
Yeah.
And that they don't have enough personnel. And therefore, why should they waste all that personnel doing something that didn't need to be done?
Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Rhonda, thank you very much. And all that money. I mean, just consider the money. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out that I thought it was very ironic that Scott Olson actually had to come back from war to fight for our freedoms.
Yes, he came back from two tours in Iraq to stand on the lines there in Oakland, and that's where he was injured, not in Iraq. That is ironic.
Right, right. But the point I'm trying to make is that the wars that we're fighting have nothing to do with protecting our freedoms. They're about corporate colonialism. Yeah. And I think practically every war since World War II, and even partially including World War II, have been about corporate colonialism. And the politicians really like to say that it's about protecting our freedoms. And I have nothing against our troops. I don't think it's anything that they do. I think there should be a boycott of the military in this country. But basically, it's corporate colonialism. That's why we fight these wars.
And Smedley Butler said it really, really well, that he was a stooge for the corporations when he was the top Marine in the United States Marine Corps and was invading, as I recall, Panama, and that's what he was doing. Thank you, Noah. Excellent point. And well said, I would say. Stan in Gambrills, Maryland. Hey, Stan, what's up? We got a minute to the end of this hour, by the way, Stan.
All right. This is the corporate personhood. In Mississippi, they're going to be voting on ballot initiative 26 to amend the state constitution by redefining person to include every human being from the moment of fertilization, cloning, or the equivalent thereof.
Right.
How would that affect the capability of corporations to donate money, since they would be excluded from this definition, by this definition?
It doesn't. They have crafted that language very carefully to not interfere with corporate personhood. What it will interfere with is the ability of women to use birth control pills, to use IUDs, and basically, as soon as a woman becomes pregnant, the state can then assign a lawyer to her who can follow her around and make sure that she doesn't engage in any risky activity. The state could even arguably put a blood alcohol detector on her that pierces her skin and continuously monitors her blood alcohol and transmits that information back to some central pregnancy police place to make sure that she doesn't put that zygote and ultimately fetus at any kind of risk by having a drink, for example. So this is a massive expansion of state power under the guise of conservative values. It boggles my mind.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So earlier in the program, we had on Dom Aratsarena, who is the president of the Oakland Police Officers Association. And I don't want to put words in his mouth. I think I'm accurately characterizing what he said when he said that the police were ordered to be there by the mayor's office or by the civilian city government. But the specific tactics that they used and whether or not they would use rubber bullets and tear gas and things, those were decisions made by the police and not the civilian authorities. I thought that was very interesting. Ron Kuby is on the line with us. He's an icon in the legal community in New York and frankly, around the country. Kuby Law is the website, KUBYlaw.com. And Ron, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's great to hear you. And of course, you and I did back-to-back shows long ago and far away when Air America existed.
Yes, yes. I didn't know if you wanted to be identified as a former talk show host
no,
also or not.
So. You know what? Everybody who is not a current talk show host
is a former talk show.
There you go. Okay. So, and everybody who isn't, and maybe a future one.
Right. That's right.
Particularly given the state of podcasting, there's some actually damn good stuff out there. Ron Kuby, let me just play this clip. This has kind of gone viral, and this is, Jacob just fired this thing off.
He wanted me to get on the sidewalk, and he grabbed this arm and asked him to get on the sidewalk. There's a lot of people, so there's no sidewalk to get on, and I just kept moving, and he punched me.
Did you hit this deputy inspector? Did you hit this officer?
I absolutely didn't.
Did not?
I did not.
Okay, so, Ron, you're in New York. This took place in New York, and, you know, when was this? Where was this? What was going on? Describe to us what we just heard.
Okay, we go back to October 14th, which was a very important day in the Zuccotti Park Occupy Wall Street movement, because that was the day that the New York City Police Department was going to clear out the park, force everybody out, ostensibly for cleaning purposes, but they weren't going to allow people back in with their tents and sleeping bags, effectively ending the occupation.
Right.
At the last minute, city officials prevailed on the private owner of the park and said, please don't do this. It's a really big mistake. And the owners of the park said, okay, fine, we won't do it. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, they called off the planned eviction. Thousands and thousands of people had gone down to Zuccotti as sort of a nonviolent civil disobedience last stand.
Show of solidarity.
Right, and instead of, like, lamenting what had been lost, there was a celebratory mood as to what had been won. The occupation continues. So there was a march at about 8:30 in the morning, and not far from Zuccotti. And the police were not happy. They had come juiced for combat. You know, they expected they were going to be cleaning out, arresting, and probably tussling with thousands and thousands of protesters, and this was finally going to be their moment. We're finally putting an end to this. So they were juiced up more than they should have been. And it took them a while to calm down. And in the course of the celebratory demonstration, people were walking in the street, and
which is technically illegal. It's called jaywalking.
Yeah, totally illegal. It's also occupying, you know, blocking pedestrian and vehicular traffic. Although,
right,
you know, the truth is there was no vehicular traffic except the police, who had closed down the street in anticipation of the march. So, you know, put aside the cosmic question, can you block traffic when there's no traffic? Because the police have blocked traffic because they think you're going to block traffic.
Right.
You know, we can sort of put that meditation aside.
It's a Zen koan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, man, very heavy. And the scooters, the police scooters started trying to disperse the crowd in the street. And, you know, you try to disperse somebody with a police scooter, you knock them down or hit them. I mean, it's not really a great dispersal technique, but it was pretty effective. And eventually the march just sort of dissolved, and Felix Rivera Pitre, who's 37 years old, a gay rights activist, AIDS activist, HIV positive, living on social assistance, and, you know, is involved in a lot of advocacy groups. You know, he's not some trustafarian. Very much, you know, part of the real life 99%, you know, and he's close.
Trustafarian being the trust fund babies, you mean?
Yeah. I don't know if that term has caught on yet, the trustafarians. And you know, he's not one of them. And, in fact, very few of the Occupy Wall Street folks that I've met are. He's walking, and Deputy Inspector Johnny Cardona. Now, a deputy inspector is a very high-ranking police official. He wears a white shirt, but in the military, he's, you know, the equivalent of a major, if you will.
Wow.
So, you know, this is not some rookie kid. This is a commander who has no business being in the middle of this to begin with. He should be in some mobile command post directing it.
Right.
He grabs Felix by the arm and tells him, get on the sidewalk. Felix turns around, and you see this in the video, and, you know, Felix is sort of flamboyantly gay. His hair is in a bun. You know, he's, you know, he has very much a queen look that he loves.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell that Felix just turns around, looks at him with such utter contempt and disdain, and says, you know, there's no sidewalk to get onto, because the whole sidewalk was occupied.
Right.
And at that moment, Felix turns to walk away. Cardona grabs him, spins him around, and in slow motion, we can watch Cardona's fist going back, his elbow goes back, and boom! Right hook takes Felix right down, one punch, on video.
Punches him in the face.
you know, so hard that it takes him down. It knocked out his earring, tore up his earlobe, and the video went viral. Hours and hours after the video went viral, Deputy Inspector Cardona then files a complaint against Felix, claiming that Felix attempted to elbow Cardona in the face. I was, you know, defending myself. He attacked me first.
Right.
And the video doesn't show it because the camera wasn't on yet. Well, you know, thanks to the world of young people and high-tech wizards, is within a few hours of that statement being made, another piece of video appeared that showed the whole encounter and again showed that Cardona was completely lying about everything that had happened. And at this point, the district attorney's office in New York County is actually conducting a criminal investigation of Deputy Inspector Cardona. It turns out this was the third time in a month that he had physically assaulted Occupy Wall Street protesters.
Wow.
So one earlier one on September 21st is on a website now. The New York Times blog actually put it on the website. And you can see the same punch where he takes out another demonstrator 3 weeks earlier.
So this is a guy who is basically using his police uniform to do what if you or I walked up to somebody and did, we would end up in jail facing simple assault charges.
Right. The first time we did this, we would be arrested, charged with misdemeanor assault, probably released on bail, or even on our own recognizance if we have no criminal record. The second time we did it, when we were out on bail,
right,
we would be remanded because, right, you know, the judge would say, sorry,
right,
you are
no
now
more
charged
bail
with the same thing again. I'm not going to let you out.
Ron, we have just a minute left. What's the resolution of this? Where is this going right now?
The only place that it can go in a just and fair society that depends on law and order is some actual criminal charges be brought against Cardona and he be separated from his pepper spray, his badge, and his gun.
Yeah, and he keeps his fist, but he no longer has the immunity to use it. And are you making that happen?
I don't have the power to make it happen except the power of persuasion, but I am cautiously optimistic that eventually Cardona will get the same deal.
You can't make it happen because you're not a prosecutor.
Right.
You could only bring a civil lawsuit. You're talking about
power.
A criminal action against
him. If somebody wants to give me state power, I'll make it happen.
So, have you talked with the city prosecutor,
yep,
or what?
And we met with the district attorney's office on Monday. I'm cautiously optimistic that at the very least, you know, Cardona will end up on probation and some anger management, which is a real good idea.
Because this is one of the problems, frankly, that police departments have is the bad apples within the department. And apparently, I wasn't there. I can't judge this guy, but from your story, it sounds pretty grim.
I'm psycho.
Well,
my view.
Ron Kuby, KubyLaw.com. You can read all about it. Ron, thanks for being with us today. And fascinating story. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, in New York, in that case, or in Oakland, where you have police violence, who's responsible? The mayor who ordered the police to clear the park, or the police who used rubber bullets and fists? Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Jason in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? Hey, my big thing is about, you know, everybody keeps talking about the stimulus this and stimulus that. I mean, hell, after you have your first cup of coffee, you're stimulated. But after you have your fifth or sixth, you ain't stimulated anymore. And actually, it becomes detrimental. And this idea that, you know, you're going to prop up the housing market, prop up the car market and so forth, it's just a big joke. Because right now there's 18 million homes vacant in the United States. We don't have to build another house for 3 years.
Right.
So there's no stimulating.
That's assuming people can get mortgages to buy those 18 million homes. What we need is fundamental structural change. We need to undo the damage that Phil Gramm did to this country with Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. We need to undo the damage of the free trade policies that go from Reagan through Clinton. We need to undo that damage. We need to have a national trade policy and manufacturing policy. We need to bring those jobs back home. We need to change our tax policies with regard to the very, very rich and roll back the Reagan tax cuts. I mean, these are fundamental structural things that all came out of Reaganomics and all are continuing as a consequence of the continuation of Reaganomics. And they would bring those jobs back home. They would give us back an economy. And as you correctly point out, it wouldn't be like snorting Coke.
Well, I mean, and the other thing is, you know, when people keep talking about the schools and stuff like that, how we're using an educational method that's over 100 years old, the way we're teaching. If anything, we should be finding ways of teaching kids with less teachers, not more teachers. I mean, it's a great thing about this guy Khan, the Khan Academy, about teaching all these kids through the internet and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great idea, but the problem, though, is why are we still using these antiquated methods?
Well, some of those methods actually work, but yeah, I'm all in favor of modernizing education. I don't know about the less teachers, more teachers thing. That's a whole different discussion, but you're right that our educational models are grounded in Maria Theresa.
I'm with you on this thing about people and vote. I mean, people, you know, corporations not being people, but are we going to go along with the same thing that basically only an individual can donate to political campaigns, or am I going to be able to be a union person and somehow I'm not in favor of a candidate, but my union can donate for me? Are we going to eliminate that also?
Well, that's a very good question. A, unions are democracies, corporations aren't. But B, I'm of the opinion that unions and corporations should not be people. So, you know, in answer to your question, your somewhat loaded question. But back to the education. Education is being done based on a model Maria Theresa, who was the queen or whatever her title was of Austria in the 1700s, in the 18th century, started this thing called the Spinnenschulen. And it was a deal she cut with local parents. If your kids would come in and for the first half of the day they would spin clothing, for the second half of the day we will teach them instead of paying them. And parents did this. And this was the origin of our modern school system. And it evolved into a school system to provide, you know, good robots for the army and good kids for industry, you know, good workers for industry, that kind of thing. But don't get me started on education. Mina in St. Paul, Nebraska. Hey, Mina, what's up?
Hi there. I just wanted to let your listening audience know, and especially those in Central Nebraska, that we are having a Occupy Wall Street solidarity gathering in March this Saturday, the 5th of November.
Great.
We'll be meeting in Grand Island, Nebraska at Pioneer Park. That's the 600 block between 2nd and 3rd Streets.
Okay.
We'll have a few speeches. We'll then walk west to Wall Street Fargo Bank and spend about 15 minutes there. And then continue west to Representative Adrian Smith's office. And we hope to put some notes under the door for him.
Okay, that's great. Mina, thank you for calling, and thanks for the announcement, and thanks for your patriotic activities. I salute you. Thank you very much. Linda in Prescott, Arizona. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Along these lines of corporatization of military and rooting for the interests of oil, the very people who were protecting to get the oil don't want to pay for the military to get that oil.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
Well, it's a fact. ExxonMobil, for example, one of the most profitable corporations in the world, made tens of billions of dollars in profits last year, paid no U.S. income tax, and yet much of what our military does, I don't know if it's most, but a significant portion of what our military does right now is protect shipping lanes, and our shipping lanes are heavily used by the oil industry. We're importing $1 billion a day worth of oil, and all of those imports are protected by our military, particularly the Navy. And the oil companies are not, you know, what percentage of the cost of that are the military is being paid for by the oil companies? Bupkis. Nothing. Zip. In fact, to the contrary, we're handing them billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies. So you and I are paying to protect them, then they're right, and their right to make money. Excellent point, Linda. Thank you for calling and making it. David in Sacramento. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been spending the last, three weekends down at the Occupy Sacramento,
mm-hmm.
And last Sunday down there, we heard nothing but stories about kind of police brutality, kind of off the scenes. Once some in the jail, after people are brought in for various offenses related to the
right.
Occupy, they're getting beat and abused, and heard stories it's very depressing.
Yeah, it is. It's turning, you know, I think the right and the media in the United States are turning this into a generational battle. They're basically reprising the notion of hippies and these young people are hippies and they're just, Curtis Sliwa was on this program earlier just spouting this stuff, you know. It's just like Woodstock all over again. All I want to do is screw and get high. And you know, that's not at all the case.
Fighting all those wars.
Right, and it's not at all the case. That is the right-wing propaganda machine. Frankly, I was very sad to hear Curtis Sliwa, you know, a guy who I think at one point in his life was doing some good stuff, spouting these right-wing isms. And pardon?
He's been captured.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to speculate on his motives. I don't, you know, I know Curtis somewhat, and he's a colleague in that he's a talk show host, but and he's not here to defend himself. But I will say that I think that one of the things that is motivating much of this kind of secondary police violence, beating kids up in the jails, off sites, things like that, this cop that Ron Kuby was talking about, is that there is this giant right-wing talk machine out there that is portraying these protesters as basically hippies.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And in defense of the hippies, you know, we had Danny Kohlberg on talking about this last week. I think they're a pretty important political movement, too. We'll be back with the good, the bad, and the ugly. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very quisquilliantly ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Chicago. A group of city aldermen plan to introduce an ordinance at the city council's meeting to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana. They believe decriminalization will save the city millions of dollars and free up police to investigate actual serious crimes. Under the new law, people caught with 10 grams or less of marijuana will be ticketed and fined rather than sent to jail. Let's hope other cities take note and we end Nixon's war on drugs for good. The bad, Rush Limbaugh. This week, this is what Rush had to say.
Sexual harassment is a political tool invented by the left to get rid of people, to shut people down, or to score money gains.
All right. Actually, sexual harassment is a very serious issue. And the very, very ugly New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, billionaire and one percenter. Considering that the Occupy Wall Street movement is based in his city, you'd think he'd be a little more careful when defending banksters. Responding to questions about Occupy Wall Street, Mayor Bloomberg said, "I hear your complaints. Some of them are totally unfounded. It was not the banks that created the mortgage crisis. It was plain and simple Congress who forced everybody to go and give mortgages to people who are not on the who are on the cusp." End of quote. Actually, no. 84% of the subprime mortgages lent out in 2006 at the peak came from private lending institutions, not government-backed institutions like Fannie and Freddie. Mayor Bloomberg simply has the facts wrong. And nobody was forced to give a mortgage to anybody. And to try to give blanket immunity to banksters while thousands of patriots are camped out in New York City and getting arrested to protest the crimes on Wall Street shows just how tone-deaf this billionaire mayor is. Let them eat cake, right? That's very, very ugly. Yeah. It is. It really is. You know, you think about it. It's pretty amazing. Rob in Oakland, California. Hey, Rob, what'd you think about hearing your police department's spokesperson on the show?
Mr. Hartman, thank you for the free speech time. Yeah, you know, I was telling your call screener, we've been dealing with this for many years, all the way back to the crack invasion of the 1980s. And for me, it's kind of the same soup warmed over when it comes to the militaristic activity of the Oakland Police Department, Tom. My thing is we have to free Oakland from the restraints of our police department, which has had, for better or worse, a lot of involvement in some of the heinous brutality and harassment against citizens in this country and corruption that goes unseen because of whatever reason. People don't like to harken back and look at Oakland and its record here. But if you do, you have to look at, for me, when it comes to the occupiers, every group that ever rose up here, Mr. Hartman, had an agenda. And I'm just asking these occupiers who want to occupy Oakland, you want to shut down things. I see some of my friends out there, too, and I'm watching helicopters fly over me right now. It all looks pretty. But what's the next phase, Mr. Hartman? What do they want? For me, I want an investigation and a table opened up where we can dialogue in this country about the proliferation of automatic weapons in our urban communities. And Oakland is one of the strongholds of that, as well as other cities.
Sure.
So, you know, my thing, Mr. Hartman, to you is, you being a learned professional that you are and a scholar, what do we do next? What's next for the occupiers? What do you want in return? It's enough to shut things down, but what do you want back? I want to see the proliferation of automatic weapons in our urban communities curtailed.
Good.
Thank you, Ms. Armour.
Excuse me. I'm so in agreement. I lost control. I'm with you on that. A lot of people have been out there working on that for a long, long time. Mark Carlin over at BuzzFlash.com, for example. You know, totally with you. But here's, you know, to ask me what I want out of that movement, I want the movement to continue as a movement and become whatever it becomes. That's the extraordinary thing about America and the extraordinary thing about movement politics is that movement politics is driven from the bottom up. It's driven by the people. I mean, we're seeing a lot of these groups start passing ordinances a lot of these general assemblies say, you know, okay, let's have a statement that corporations aren't people and money isn't speech, for example. It's come out of about a half a dozen of them so far. I think that's great. Do away with automatic weapons or semi-automatic weapons even in the inner cities, you know, stronger gun control laws. All in favor of that. And as long as this is at the will of the local people. But with regard to your indictment of the police department, this is something that's really, really important that Americans, I think, don't get. You don't see this kind of police brutality in, for example, Norway, where cops are actually paid a really good salary and it's hard to become a police officer. It is amazing to me how being a police officer in this country, in so many communities in this country, it's not that difficult to get in some cases, although it's getting more and more difficult now that we're laying them off. But it also has become like this should be a highly paid profession, and we should demand highly paid professional standards of our police. And frankly, I think the same is true of our teachers. When we start paying our police and our teachers the way that we pay our doctors and our lawyers, then you're going to see a society that suddenly gets a whole lot more well-educated and is a whole lot more civil. And other countries have figured this out, and we need to, too. So, anyhow, enough on that. Joe in Palm Bay, Florida. Hey, Paul. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi. I was wondering if you could educate me. The recent ruling in Tennessee that they were not to arrest any more of the protesters, as it was a violation of freedom of speech and freedom of gathering.
Right.
Is that going to roll over into other states? And if so, how and how long is it going to take?
Yeah, it was not a federal judge. It was a state judge, if my recollection is correct. And therefore, it will not apply to any other states. It will be subject to being appealed to the state Supreme Court and conceivably could be taken to a federal court, probably will be. And, you know, this kind of question may well end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. I think with the 5-4 split that we have on the U.S. Supreme Court, where the five right-wingers on the court almost always side with power, police, the top 1%, and transnational corporations, and virtually never, ever side with, you know, average working people, I'm a little pessimistic at the moment. I think, however, you know, a couple, 2, 3, 4 years down the road, if we can maintain a Democrat in the White House and if, you know, some of these right-wingers on the Supreme Court are retired, if Clarence Thomas decides to do the right thing and resign in disgrace, whatever, that there could be a change. But right now, that's just in Tennessee, and that's, by the way, the exception to the rule. In most cases where there are court challenges to attempts to clear these parks, they're being upheld by local courts. So, you know, it's one small victory in a sea of losses.
Are you aware of any other law actions being taken in other states as there were in Tennessee?
I know that there have been challenges in a number of other cities to the occupations, and I know so far, I mean, I shouldn't say I know. My understanding is that so far none of them have been successful, as was the one in Tennessee. It was successful. So, you know, that's the best I have for you, Joe. I'm sorry. It's a moment, right? It's just a moment. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
By the way, Exxon's profits last year were about $2,000 per family of four in this country.
Really?
Yeah.
You mean every family of four in the United States had.
If it was $140 billion, as you said.
Right.
And there are 300 million in the people, that's $467 per person.
Wow. And so if they had simply dropped the price of a gallon of gas down to a buck a gallon.
So anyway, quick point before I get my main thing. If anybody is going to run for office, you may have a major deadline in your state. You've got to be registered with your party now, because you have to be registered with your party a year beforehand in some places.
Okay. So pay attention to those things if you're thinking of running for political office. Good advice, Joe.
Tony, I was at the Denver Occupy Action, on Saturday, and wanted to give some perspective there. You were talking about the nonviolence aspect of people throwing things in Oakland, even just a little bit. You don't want to give the police any reason to act.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I would definitely put most of the onus of the problem on the police. They were there being drama queens, making everything seem much worse. I mean, when you're escorting marchers down the street and you're blocking out the next street, you have to cruise down the street with your pedal floored at 50 miles an hour, things like that. And they used an automatic gas pellet weapon to shoot a guy in a tree nearly a dozen times who was...
Is this what you saw in Denver you're talking about?
Yes, this is Denver.
Okay. All right.
And there's a guy sitting in a tree taking pictures. He was ordered out of the tree. And about 10 seconds later, the policeman shot him repeatedly. I mean, you look at his wounds. They're pretty bad. They shot him over and over again with gas pellets. Just because he didn't get out of the tree immediately, you have to shoot him that many times. Even once is too much.
Right.
So the police were pretty bad, but I would definitely say the crowd was not nonviolent. There were a few things thrown, but if you look at the aspects of violence, there's also verbal violence. They had a group of small cadre of police walking into the crowd to start tearing down the tents. They had protesters then encircle them. I mean, hundreds of protesters encircling less than a dozen officers, screaming like a foot away from them. Yeah, just screaming at them at the top of their lungs, shame, shame, or whatever. If you study Gandhi and King, you'll see this is not the tactic of nonviolence at all.
Right.
And I could see the police could be very intimidated. I'd say, look at the Freedom Rider show on PBS and the I Am the Man movie on PBS.
Okay.
You learn how to really be nonviolent, because they were really intimidating the police.
And this is why SNCC and other good organizations back in the day were having nonviolence trainings. And frankly, maybe we need more of those here. Jeff, thank you very much for pointing that out. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Fukushima, by the way. Reactor 2 is starting to gas out. It looks like it might be melting down again.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You tell them, Leonard. Welcome back. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat. On the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, is democracy coming to Cannes, France, which is where the leaders of the G20 are gathering even as we speak? President Obama himself is making his way there later tonight. And news is already coming out of Cannes from various EU officials regarding Greece. Greece, who, of course, has ticked off everybody in the Eurozone by potentially blowing up the Eurozone deal by saying that they're going to hold a referendum on it.
They're going to pull an Iceland.
Going to pull an Iceland, possibly. A couple of interesting pieces of information. One is that Reuters first broke this, that EU and IMF board sources are saying that Greece is unlikely to get its sixth tranche of bailout aid until the referendum has been held. That's 8 billion euros. And Greece has been waiting for this for quite a long time now, amid reports that it would have to default, basically.
So they're basically blackmailing Greece.
Yes, and they're saying that the IMF board is saying they need assurances that Greece can meet its obligations before handing over the money. In other words, they're also saying, look, they're not going to give you 8 billion euros if Greece might decide to quit the EU next month.
I think it's time for Greece to just follow Paul Krugman's advice, I mean, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and just say, okay, guys, see you later. We're going back to the drachma. You know?
Well, the question apparently has been decided by Greece of what they're going to ask in the referendum, and it's not going to be to approve or reject the terms of the financial rescue. It's going to be a broader question, and it's going to be centered on support for Greece's membership of the European Union and the 17-nation Eurozone. And that's,
oh, that's
really
interesting.
Thought that Papandreou is much more likely to get a yes vote, yes.
So this is for the referendum that is going to be put to the Greek people?
Yes, this is the referendum for the Greek people. So it will be whether you support or reject Greece's, I don't know how it'll be phrased, but Greece's membership of the European Union and the 17-nation Eurozone.
And what goes along with that is that we pay back the banksters.
Right, but it won't be phrased that way.
Right.
And
of course. Not.
Yeah.
Of course not.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. And Cannes, France, Louise and I have some history. It's the one city in France, where we had a traveling across Europe with our three children, and they were fairly young at the time, where we actually had four taxi drivers in a row, and the only four who were there at the train station refused to take us to a hotel because we didn't speak French.
No.
Honest,
no.
True story. Yes, we ended up having to hop on a bus, and the bus driver wouldn't give us change because we didn't speak French.
Oh, la la.
It was an interesting time. Yes.
Oh, that's dreadful.
So anyway, what else is going on?
Well, a House committee today has approved new and tougher penalties against Iran, focusing on companies that do business with Tehran as well as its central bank. This is the House Foreign Affairs Committee. It approved two bills aimed at clamping down on Iran's nuclear weapons program.
Mm-hmm.
And now the U.S. and the U.N. have imposed several rounds of penalties already because of widespread suspicions Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons, which, of course, Iran denies, says its programs for peaceful purposes. This happening at the same time as a very interesting story coming out of the U.K. via The Guardian, that the Ministry of Defense over there is believing that the U.S. may well decide to fast-forward plans for targeted missile strikes at some key Iranian facilities, nuclear missile facilities, because the U.S. is so concerned that Iran is getting really very, very far advanced with its nuclear plans.
I thought this worm was taking down the Iranian system pretty quickly.
Yes, this Stuxnet worm had done quite a lot of work, but apparently they've heard that the Iranians have been moving some new, more efficient centrifuges into the heavily fortified military base dug beneath a mountain at the city of Qom.
Hmm.
And they're very worried that they're getting so far advanced that soon the missile strikes won't be able to even reach where they need to get, so that they want to move forward with the missile strikes. So they're concerned. The concern is that if they don't do something fairly soon, it will be too late.
And, you know, I mean, North Korea has nukes. India has nukes. Pakistan has nukes. If France has nukes. There's nukes all over the place.
There are.
I just don't see how Iran having nuclear weapons is going to. I suppose it would give them some more juice in the Middle East, but. You know, are you really going to use a nuke against a country that might be upwind of you?
I don't know the answer to that. They seem to be very concerned that Iran is what they call newly aggressive, and we are not quite sure why. And they're citing three recent assassination plots on foreign soil, and they do believe that these were coordinated by elements in Tehran. And they do think that they've restored all the capability they lost in the Stuxnet computer worm cyber attack last year. So they don't quite know what Iran is up to, but they are very concerned. And for some reason, this is the one country that they are absolutely bound and determined should not get these nukes. They also think that Barack Obama doesn't want to, while he doesn't want to really embark on a new venture before next November, if he is going to do a strike, it's more likely to do it, say, in the spring than during the middle of a presidential election campaign, say, in the summer or the fall.
Yeah. I wonder if Israel will simply do it for us.
Well, they feel that Israel might, but they are also preparing for the eventuality that it could go in this direction also.
Yeah, of course, if Israel did that, that would provide, you know, the rationalization for all sorts of awful things. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, Who Are the 1%? Brave New Foundation is launching a new campaign tomorrow. We'll talk with Robert Greenwald about it. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate, when you get involved, whether it's a phone call or it's actually getting out in the streets. So anyhow, tag, you're it. Occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.